Listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.
The old master painter from the faraway hills painted the violets and the daffodils. He put the purple in the twilight haze, then did a rainbow for the rainy day.
I have devoted myself recently, and of a sudden, to a curious and private project, which I have dubbed the 13ification of Corners. Attribute it to my dotage, or some other deficit in mentation, or psychology, senility, Alzheimer's, a latent twig of compulsive disorder, or just a little special way I've found to while away a little excess time. More explicitly, I am recreating from memory a certain arrangement of objects that I was intimately familiar with when I was 13 years old. I have taken an unused small den in my cabin and 13ified its corners. If I could, I would recreate my entire bedroom. I remember I had a painting above my light switch, but I can't remember what the painting was. I had a desk, but I can't remember its style or exactly where it stood. But I remember the dark shelf over my bed with its heavy set of soldiers, the wooden biplane I had hanging from white yarn from the ceiling, and even the golden tack the yarn was fixed to. I remember my old Delco radio and 4 or 5 of the top tunes of the year of 1950, which I have on cassette and would play from time to time. So, to the best of my recollective ability, I have converted an unused room into my old bedroom. It is an incomplete and dissected-looking room, as if some boy were half moved in or half moved out. I have the bed and something akin to the astronaut bedsheet I had at the time. I have the entire year of Life magazines in a string-wrapped stack on the floor. I have a shoebox full of metal cars kept on the bottom of a toy shelf. I cannot remember anything else on that shelf, though it was jammed and crammed. Next to the bed is a boy's reading table with an old General Electric bedside lantern. A few sets of cotton pajamas from Woolworths hang in the closet, and I call this 13ifying the corner, turning a space into something resembling that of my 13th year. This whole 13ification process began unconsciously at the local Lemon Library. I should say I have always enjoyed the sturdy company, the sense of completed thought, the inward, contemplative convection of books. And if there was ever a forest lined with leafy novels, I would happily take my final stroll there. The Lemon Library itself is a commonplace, an undramatic municipal structure of glass and brick, with a moderately pleasing wedge of sign and the traditional eccentric mixture of Corinthian, Baroque, and Romanesque touches, such as 4 jutting white pillars and sinewy black railings, and above the entryway a great cement fresco of charioteers writing somewhere long ago. But these dissolve at the touch as cheap facades. The pillars are of hard, knockable plastic, and the chipped fresco is simply a sidewalk concrete impressed by a mold at a factory. But it was at the Lemon Library where I 13'd my first corner, having found myself involuntarily organizing a small shelf of novels that were important to me in the year of 1950. Upon immediately entering the fluorescent-lit foyer, one is drenched in the rich canker of the old book glue, the scent of the death of paper, mixed with sweet flower librarian perfume, and a little of the fruity, jelly, dirty-fingered lunch bags of children. To the left of the foyer, and cascading back, is a periodical wall. The new bestsellers, children's classics, and general nonfiction. To the right, in a tall, woozy stagger, reference materials, history and religion, microfiche and audiovisual devices, the card catalogue, and so on. And behind the checkout desk, which lays directly ahead, is a gunmetal stairway which goes up to the so-called stacks, where the old fiction and old non-fiction titles are sent to moulder in a moist light of the bookly equivalent of a nursing home. It is up these steps I go, and to a far cat's corner, where I sit at a middle schooler's pine desk to work over my collection. I read 52 books in 1950, one book a week. I have remembered and collected 49 now along my wicked little shelf in the Lemon Library. But it seems that I have come to a standstill. For a while, daily, I stumbled over a forgotten memory. Something from Ivanhoe or Last of the Mohicans. Silvery scenes of Indians moving noiseless through the woods. Or someone gazing over a sunlit river or a wintry scene from Dickens. Such scenes then took to their root and bloomed forward into context. The Indians were heading to the fort to meet John Brown. The man looking over the river had just lost his son and had gone out hunting, etc. And the full book would be there. And I'd go searching through the stacks until I found it. If I did not say, this period of my life, the year of 1950 when I was 13, was a period of bedridden convalescence. I steadfastly kept my vigil and was a deep, deep, continual reader. Books were stacked by my bedside and tumbled on the floor, and even as thermometers and needles went in and out of my body, my eyes never left the page. In my corner of the stacks at the Lemon Library, at about eye level, is my curious run of some 49 novels. I have almost completely 13'd this corner. Will I remember and find my remaining books? I don't know. I suppose it would be the law of nature that I must forget a few. To be clear, this is not an endeavour born of nostalgia, nor do I have an interest in this year simply because a year in bed so stridently holds itself apart from the rest of one's life, but because all of my current life seems to emanate directly and entirely from this point, this year in bed. In a way, I have been given a gift of narrow focus. Not many others may examine so small a thing and come away with so much. A year, in this instance, which itself was so contained. Most people's lives emerge more steadily, more stealthily in dribs and drabs, a bit here, a bit there, fragments so fragmentary and discontiguous they can never be sewn back into familiar cloth. But my rags, I suppose, may come together, and the gossamer fabric I may one day be able to lift from the weaver's table will be a roughly perfect representation of the things that made me, myself in things, as formed by objects, ideas, the maker's mould, the shaper's hands, the soft hammers that plied me. As though the cement fresco of the charioteers that decorates the Lemon Library had the wish to travel to the factory that made it, to move toward the machines, the artisans, the mould block that held it tight to form, to finally see the things that made it.
The whole town's talking about the Jones boy. The Jones boy, the Jones boy, the whole
town's talking about the Jones boy. He acts mighty peculiar now. The whole town's saying he was a good boy, a nice boy, a swell boy. The whole town thinks that he's not a well boy. He just isn't the same somehow. He hops, he jumps so merrily over the water pumps. He stops and then he'll come to a pump and he'll jump again. They're buzzing over the fences that he's gone out of his senses. The whole town's talking about the Jones boy, the poor boy, the Jones boy. But I just happen to be the Jones boy, and I happen to be in love, yes, I happen to be in love. Talking about the Jones boy, oh, that Jones boy, yes, that Jones boy. The whole town's talking about the Jones boy. He acts mighty peculiar now. Oh, the whole town's saying he was a good boy, a nice boy, a swell boy. The whole town thinks that he's not a well boy. He just isn't the same somehow. He hops, he jumps so merrily over the water pumps. He stops and then he'll come to a pump and he'll jump again. They're buzzing over the fences and he's gone out of his senses. Oh, the whole town's talking about the Jones boy, poor boy, Jones boy. But I just happen to be the Jones boy, and I happen to be in love.
There is an adolescent boy I often see at the library, perhaps 13, perhaps 14. An odd dresser, the only boy I've ever seen who wears a vampire-style cape. He has crooked black glasses and carries, usually in hand, something very much like a magic wand. I would think he was shooting for the magician's look, were it not for the fact that he is so filthy. The dirt on his face and hands is equal to that on his boots and trouser legs. His attention to his appearance as a magical type boy is cancelled by his lack of attention to his appearance, for he is a very dirty looking boy. Harvey Porter, as I have heard the librarians moan at his arrival, also seems to have no inclination or requirement for schooling, and the librarians find him strange enough to be ignored, perhaps put off by his alien bearing, and never report him to any truant officer or approach him in any way. We have seen each other, Harvey and I, and we seem to recognize each other as misusers of the library tool. As I am busy 13ing my corner, Harvey is eccentrically preoccupied in his cubby. I thought when we first came eye to eye that Harvey was recognizing a fellow hoodlum element in me, but as our relations continued, I came to see a distinctly respectful quality in his look. If I am not mistaken, he now engages in a small bow to me, as though having some opinion about my station in the world, and I am given to feel a little like Winston Churchill catching the eye of an admiring boy during one of my stirring speeches. As I have my special place, Harvey has his. After entering the library, sharing our hellos, Harvey will take up his position in the demilitarized teenager section of the first floor, hidden from the main desk a bit behind the reference materials, but still visible to me at my supervisory level. There are a number of bins and spinnable turnstiles thick with young person literature in this area, silly fluff about dragons and homework, kissing girls and frightening mean old ladies in grand old houses on high dark hills, who turn out to be kindly witches. There is a knife-injured table, fully embroidered with blue pen graffiti, and some slightly modified reading chairs, and in the corner, a mass of coloured and tatty pillows, upon which the boys and girls may casually flop while browsing their selections. There is also a radiator, which in the winter revels in a hammery digestion and trots out a hot air through a paint-peeled topmost grate. A grate that may be removed by clever fingers, Harvey Porter having such fingers. Before launching into the pillows, Harvey quickly moves to a familiar shelf, unclips his vampire cape, and grabs a book. It is always the same book. Then, into the pillows with the book he goes, scrimmaging and self-burying himself until he is actually lost from view. He may stay beneath the pillows for an hour or so, reading the book, I presume, but eventually, like a deep-sea diver, he comes sputtering up for air. You sit for a moment, treading in his pillows, red-faced, hard-breathing, getting used to the cool, refreshing above-pillow atmosphere. Then he'll slowly emerge from the colourful mass and quietly move back to the radiator, where he sneaks open the grate and removes a rolled-up notebook. He then takes the notebook to a desk, sits for a time writing, before taking both the book and the notebook back to the pillows for a second deep-sea adventure. The end of the session sees a return of the notebook to the grate and a return of the book to its proper place on the shelf, after which time Harvey leaves, sometimes running, as though he had done a fairly awful deed. As it happens, Harvey's efforts helped remind me of a notebook that I kept for a time during my formative year. Thus, my 13-ification grew to include a new target, my old notebook, and the subject therein. I remembered that I fancied myself as something of a writer, and I realized that as enormously focused on reading as I was also focused on writing. But what I wrote absolutely eluded me. I could only now recall that I read and wrote in alternation, much in the way that Harvey Porter seemed to. Thus Harvey struck me, and I began to watch him now for clues to my own hidden self. Somehow I suspected his boyhood manner might flare a memory. Perhaps the contents of my own feverish writing would return to me via Harvey's adolescent pencil chewing, and like a collector searching for the rarest element of his collection, I grew fiercely single-minded, and it soon came to me that an examination of the hidden notebook might prove instructive. So, one afternoon, after Harvey fled the library, I wandered down to the cubby, and with a little more noise and fanfare than I wished, I got the grate open and extracted the notebook. I hastened up the stairs, back to the stacks at my corner desk. My heart was pounding as I opened the frayed, cheap, spiral notebook, as though I were about to look upon my own long-ago writings. Empty. I was shocked. I flipped weakly through the pages, all blank. Returning to the front, I did finally see some faint imprint on the page, and I had, of course, seen him writing. But now I realized that he must be ripping the pages out in the safety of his pillow fort. I returned to the radiator and replaced the notebook. There were a few girls now lounging on the pillows, giggling to each other behind large fashion magazines. The only other clue would be the book itself. I moved to Harvey's shelf. I was troubled to find a bland collection of tall, thin, stiff scientific books for children. From my position in the stacks, I had never gotten a good sense of where on the shelf he was grasping, and so I searched the titles, although doubting I could really narrow it down. Books on geology, rocks, biology, boredom. I was about to give up when my eye came to rest on a soft red book with a faint green title. It was surely misplaced. I reread the title to myself several times. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. I took the book from its position. At the moment, I was too excited, having found the book, to gather that Harvey Porter was doing what I had been, keeping a special book out of its prescribed location for private purposes. Our secrets were indeed, structurally at least, quite the same. I took the children's novel upstairs. As I placed the book down on my desk, about to crack it open, I realized that Harvey Porter had disfigured the cover by taping two scraps of paper to it. On the first torn scrap, Harvey had retitled the book, Harvey Porter and the Pot of Hair, and in the second scrap, he'd drawn a pot which contained a massive scribble, which I assumed must be the hair. I opened Harvey Porter and the Pot of Hair, and was not surprised to see that the first 30 or so pages had been co-opted. Harvey was writing his own account of the story. His method, I gathered, was to write in his notebook, rip the page out, cut the text down to size, and then tape the new page over the old. Curiously, his taping job was careful enough to allow one to flip back the Harvey page so that one might see the legitimate page. At any rate, I began to read. Harvey Porter, of number 7 Ramage Road, in the town of Lemon, woke up, but his grandmother was dead. She said it would happen, and he had waited, but he couldn't believe it when it did. They had talked about what to do when it happened, and she had written down the phone numbers of who to call. His favorite book was the Harry Potter books, and so he started to read them again to feel better. He called Mr. Hopkins, who came to get her. Later, Mr. Hopkins was supposed to come back to get Harvey, but he didn't. And then a few days later, when Harvey called the same number, he learned that Mr. Hopkins was dead too. So it seemed like everyone was dead who knew about this, except Harvey. Harvey didn't want to go to school because he was bullied, because he looked and acted just like Harry Potter, but not on purpose. Most of it was there to begin with, in that he was an orphan waiting to become a wizard. He showed the other kids how he had a scar, even back in the 3rd grade class photo, before Harry Potter ever showed up. He showed how his name was Harvey Porter, and how he'd always worn glasses and had messy hair, and how he got his first magician kit when he was 6 and had a magic wand in his pocket. It was true that he'd moved into the closet under the stairs, just like Harry Potter, and it was also true that he had a stuffed owl named Hedwig, and that every day he went to the mailbox hoping for letters from Ron and Hermione. He also knew in his heart that some day Hagrid would come and burst the door down and take him off to Hogwarts, where he'd finally be happy and with kids like himself who weren't muggles. Or they could be mudbloods or muggles as long as they were like him, and that soon he would be a reluctant hero, even though he was reluctant. I stopped reading here, peeled back Harvey's text, and began to read the actual novel. After several hours of very deep going with both texts, I placed Harvey Porter and the Pot of Hair back into its special slot between the science texts, and I went outside. A cool wind, a sunny afternoon, the noises of children at play. I walked down Batten Way until Pine Street, down Pine Street to Meadow Street. Meadow Street headed out of town to the countryside, dividing Lemon from the next town, and just after the Larkin Farm I knew, though I'd never driven down it, was a dirt road that disappeared down a tree-lined hill. Ramage Road. I was standing in front of number 7 Ramage Road in the town of Lemon. It was a small yellow cottage, a cape, as people who care about such things might call it. There was a backdrop of birches and pines and oaks, and behind me an open field of yellow grass and toppled mossy stones from a long-ago farmer's fence. The door was painted black, and there were thin brownish curtains hung in the windows. There was a bicycle with flat tires leaning into the front hedges, and some odd implements from the kitchen here and there on the front yard. A hand blender, a carving fork, measuring cups. And although it bore the number 7, I had not seen a single other home on the street, and the street itself seemed to die into the driveway. I could hear in the distance behind the house the cold applause of Lemon Falls. The wind was a lonely wind, and I wondered whether it was possible for a 13- or 14-year-old boy to live on without assistance in such a place like this. Eventually, I felt sure some authority would overtake him. Someone would step forward to help. Although bedridden myself at that age, I felt quite old, quite adult, quite able to take care of myself. I would not have sought out any social service. I would have tried to go it on my own. I wondered how Harvey felt. I had no plans to enter. I simply wished to look over this boy's experience, as God might, omnisciently, with empathy, but with no hand out. "Professor, is that you?" I heard a small, soft voice call. I took a few steps toward the house. "Harvey," I said, "where are you?" The boy stepped awkwardly from behind a tree to one side of the house. "What are you doing there?" I asked, hoping my tone did not imply anything but curiosity. I began moving toward him. His wide eyes and nervous instabilities kept him hovering near his next words. He shifted in place as I approached. I peered around the tree. He had a little butter knife in one hand and a plastic bag in the other. The bark of the tree on his side was peeled away. Inside the bag were a few whittles of wood. "I'm getting pine shavings," he said. "Ah," I said, as though it were often my own delightful duty to do the same. "And what are your plans for the shavings?" I said. "For my potion," he said. "I suppose it'd be better to have Snape check it, but maybe you could too, Professor." "I would be happy to review your potion with you, Harvey," I said. We walked up to the front door. Harvey took out his wand, pointed it at the knob and shouted, "Hopensium!" Then looked at me. "Grandmother likes me to keep it locked when I'm outside." I nodded my agreement as we went in. "Lumos!" Harvey shouted, thrusting his wand toward the small ceiling light which clicked on. He marched past the stairs toward the kitchen. "I live in there," he said, trying to sound offhand, but he couldn't help opening the triangular-shaped door so that I could see the small bedroll on the floor, the grimy pillow, and stuffed owl hanging from the bulb chain. Harvey continued into the kitchen, and I followed. "Lumos," he said again, and the kitchen light came on. On the oven, in a pot, was a dreadful sight, a billowing pile of grey hair. I gasped. And Harvey, for his part, lowered his wand, and with all seriousness and candour, leaned toward me, touched my hand, and whispered through the daydream, "Don't worry, it's just a wig." He let go my hand and moved toward the pot of hair and let himself back into his dream. He emptied the little bag of pine shavings into the pot and stirred the cluttery soup with a large wooden spoon. "And what exactly are you making, Harvey?" I asked. "I couldn't find it in the potions book, Professor, but it's something like the Polyjuice potion. I've got my grandmother's wig, her perfume, one of her socks, some of her favourite cereal, her favourite fruit, an apple, and a chocolate bar with one bite taken out. She used to let me eat some." He smiled before continuing on with his ingredient list. "His grandmother's favourite this, bits of her clothing, jewellery." I gathered fairly quickly and was affected that the intent of the potion was to bring his grandmother back to him. But I was also again struck by how similar our projects were, how we were both trying to drive to life, vis-à-vis the assemblage of intimate objects, that which had passed into the void. At the end of Harvey's list, I sat down at the white laminate kitchen table. "May I see your wand for a moment, Harvey?" I said. He dutifully handed it to me and sat down across from me. "Are you going to snap it?" he asked. "No," I said. "Are you going to tell on me?" "No," I said again, "unless you want me to." "Are you going to make me go back to school?" I again said no. All these things were up to him. If he felt he could manage, that would have to be fine. "I do have trouble with a couple of things," he admitted.
"Such as?" I asked.
"I like the bills, and I don't know how to get the food home from the store." "Tricky things," I agreed. "And you have a lot on your mind, I'm sure." "I do," Harvey nodded vigorously. "I have a lot on my mind." We sat together for a while in silence. I am sure many people would find it surprising that I was not calling the authorities, that my first impulse was simply to look at him as though he was some creature at the zoo or some strange bit of art at the gallery. But it is not my inclination, nor a part of my nature, to approach things in this way. I am a tremendous leaver alone of people and things. I have never felt that I know any better about anyone else's life or condition, even despite their being a child. It is possibly due to some callousness or general indifference, that is true. There is also in me some Emersonian insistence that all things find their own best way. But I have trouble helping people in the accepted, civilized way. If they ask, I am happy to assist. If they do not, I am happy to pass them by. So, I finally said, bills and food seem to be the trouble spots. Bills and food, Harvey echoed, and I nodded. Although later I would sit at a desk in his grandmother's room with my checkbook and work through the small stack of the porter bills as Harvey put the groceries we'd fetched into the refrigerator. For now, I waved the wand and did my best impression of a wise old wizard and uttered the only magical phrase I could remember. Abracadabra, alakazam, let's stir these raspberries into raspberry jam. A phrase that came directly from my 13-year-old self, a phrase I'd written down countless times in my notebook, in the story I'd written about a magical boy who uses his special gifts to overcome great obstacles and become, in the sight of the world, a quite reluctant hero.
You don't even ride
Listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.